Well, have you ever heard of Bertie Munger? How about Eddie Cannonbald or Wee Willie Windle? Does that sound familiar? Maybe Mile a Minute Murphy? Well, if you're drawing a blank, don't feel bad. We don't know those names today, but if you were alive and breathing in the United States at the turn of the 20th century, these would all be household names. And no, they weren't baseball players. They were all bicycle racers in an era in which bicycle racing rivaled boxing and baseball as the most popular spectator sport in the nation. A couple other things these men all had in common. They were all white, and most of them were beaten at one time or another by another racer, an African-American named Major Taylor, who was dubbed the fastest man in the world and at one time was the world champion. More than a decade before Jack Johnson became heavyweight champion of the world and 50 years before Jackie Robinson broke the Major League color barrier, Major Taylor dominated bicycle racing, facing the intense racism of Jim Crow in the process. A new biography of Major Taylor has just been published. It's called The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. Author Michael Cranish is with us this morning. He's an investigative political reporter for The Washington Post and a co-author of the New York Times bestseller Trump Revealed, among many other books. Michael Cranish, thanks for being with us this morning on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So the America of Major Taylor's time is pretty much unrecognizable from the vantage point of 2019. Can you set the stage for us?
Sure. Well, in the mid-1890s, this was the era of the horse and buggy. It was before subways. There were a few hundred cars in the country. Those were basically rolling experiments. They typically didn't go backwards, didn't have brakes. And there were about 5 million bicycles. This was just after the invention of the bicycle we know today with two equal-sized wheels. Before that, a relative small number of people were riding these high-wheeled bicycles. People have probably seen pictures of the penny farthings, as they were known. So suddenly, when you had what was called the safety bicycle, because it was much safer to ride, this became a mass phenomenon, and everyone had to have a bicycle. It was a symbol of liberation. A woman looked at it as sort of a key component to their suffrage movement. African-Americans saw it as a way to avoid Jim Crow restrictions. And if you were in a major American city at the time, the streets and the pathways were filled with bicycles. It's hard to imagine today, but this was the very center of the bicycle craze. And it was basically a 10-year period. And into that milieu came Major Taylor, as you laid it out.
So I've actually ridden one of those high wheelers. They're terrifying.
Oh, right.
And I understand at the time that there was a tremendous amount of engineering work and work in the patent office, all related to the bicycle.
Well, that's right. I got interested in the subject a long time ago, and that was one of the facts that drew me. During the 1890s, a large number of patents were for bicycle manufacture. A lot of the people who made bicycles then switched over to auto manufacturing, so it sort of paved the way. But yes, you had an extraordinary number of people who were making bicycles. Suddenly, everyone wanted them. They were relatively affordable for the time, and it became one of the biggest industries in the country.
So it's hard not to imagine that bicycle racing was such a huge sport in the U.S. at the time. I mean, the general public now knows the sport largely because, you know, for better or worse, I guess mostly for worse, because of Lance Armstrong. But it's really kind of a marginal sport now. But give us a sense of how big it was in the 1890s.
Right. And this was a component of the sport different from what people may know about the Tour de France, for example, that Lance Armstrong and others competed in. This was, if you can imagine, across the country, there were velodromes, a wonderful word, I love that word, and these were sort of like the component, like a horse racing track or an Indy 500 track, ovals, and oftentimes there'd be 10, 20,000 people who could fit in the stands, and they drew that number regularly. One of Major Taylor's earliest races, in fact, drew 50,000 people in the mid-1890s. So it's hard to imagine that today, but this sport was actually more popular than baseball at the time. It was speed. So when you had, a little bit later in this era, motorized pacing vehicles, which was sort of like what we might today consider souped-up motorcycles, you could go in the 40-mile-per-hour range. And other than trains, people had seen nothing like this. Suddenly, this was the future. And, you know, I don't think of the bicycle today as revolutionary. At the time, this type of bicycle and the freedom that it gave you was unique.
So I imagine that many of those races saw a wager or two placed on them, right? I mean, track cycling remains a betting sport in Japan now and to a lesser extent in Asian countries like South Korea. But it's really more like horse racing where betting is as important as the actual competition. Was that the environment in which Taylor competed?
Well, there was betting, but that was, and I describe an incident where Cornelius Vanderbilt, for example, is over in Paris when he races there and bets in a race that Major Taylor is in. But it wasn't the major thing. It's not a big focus of what I write about because really, you know, people came to see the sport. It was a very exciting sport. And like I say, you know, this was just like you go to see, race cars today or whatever. This was something that was just such a spectacle, and it was the age of spectacle, and this was one of the greatest.
So this is the quintessential obvious interviewer question, and I always hate asking this question, but in your case, I really have to ask it, and you touched on it before, but you're an investigative political reporter. How did you become interested in somebody as obscure at this point as Major Taylor?
Well, I first got onto this story when I was at the Boston Globe, and this was 18 years ago. I had heard about the story of Major Taylor, and it was simply, you know, if I was giving what people call the elevator pitch, I was just so intrigued by the idea of at the height of the Jim Crow era, right after the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896 that decided separate but equal accommodations were okay. It's one of the most infamous rulings in our country's history. Just months after that, Major Taylor competes in Madison Square Garden, wins a key race, and so forth. I just wondered, you know, how did he do this? I mean, it was such a difficult era for any African-American, and here he comes along in the most popular sport and becomes a champion, eventually national and world champion. So I just, you know, like any journalist, I just got curious. It turns out that in 2001, when I first got onto this, his daughter was then 96 years old and still living. She lived in Pittsburgh. So, you know, any reporter always knows go to the oldest person first if you're doing something like this. And so I raced out to see her. She was wonderful. She had vivid recollections of seeing her father race in Paris. And I knew that she had, or she told me, one or the other, that her father's archive collection of scrapbooks, photos, letters, so forth, had been given to a museum. So I then visited the museum to go through Major Taylor's papers. And I just became more and more interested. I wrote a magazine story about him for the Boston Globe. And over the years, I heard from so many people who'd seen that story wanting to know more. And I just decided, you know, there's a larger book there. If I could write a book that's about the time. In other words, I didn't want to write a book just about an obscure, you know, racing figure. I wanted to write a book about social history, political history, race relations, and through the eyes of what I think is one of the most unique individuals in our country's history, Major Taylor.
The book is called The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. Its author, Michael Cranish, is with us this morning here on the Jefferson Exchange. There's a lot more to talk about. Taylor had a fascinating life. Stick with us. We'll be back after a break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with author Michael Cranish. He's written a new book about the extraordinary life of cyclist Major Taylor. It's called The World's Fastest Man. And we're going to be taking a look at Major Taylor and his rivals and the life and times that he lived. Michael, Taylor was born quite poor, but for the time he was actually very well educated. And you point out in your book, he was typically much better educated, better spoken than his white competitors on the bicycle track. How did he come by that education?
Well, his family lived in Indianapolis, Indiana, and they were a poor farming family. They'd come from Kentucky. His father had served for the North in the Civil War. And the father had become friends with a railroad executive, and that executive had a child who was about Major Taylor's age. Those two children became friends. This white family basically took Taylor in for extended periods and gave him a bicycle, and he learned to ride, and Major Taylor eventually went to work for some bicycle stores in Indianapolis. So he basically became like a member of that family for a while, and as a result, as you say, was pretty well educated. He was not allowed later to go to high school or college for racial reasons, but early in his life, he got a very good education there, and he later on in his life wrote an autobiography. So he was much more literate and educated than even many white people from the time, yes.
actually have his autobiography right here next to me in the studio. So a really seminal figure for most of Taylor's life was a guy named Lewis Munger, who was known as Bertie Munger. Who was he? And give us a sense of their relationship.
Well, Bertie Munger is an extraordinary figure, and in the book, in the early part, alternate chapters where I tell Bertie Munger's story, because it's another lens through which you can see this era in our country's history. He had been the world's fastest man in the high wheel era, and he had won many races and set many records riding these very large, difficult bicycles. And by the time today's version of bicycle came along in the mid-1890s, he was making bicycles, running a manufacturing company in Indianapolis, but always on the lookout for fast riders, of course. And he heard about Major Taylor in town working at local bicycle stores nearby his own company. He went to see him and then watched him race and realized that Major Taylor was one of the most extraordinary riders he'd ever seen, that he just simply without much training had come close to establishing world record marks in an informal way on local tracks, and basically took him under his wing, appropriately for a man named Bertie, gave him a state-of-the-art bicycle that he'd manufactured just for racing, and that enabled Taylor to become even better, and they became very close. Bertie Munger, it's a very unusual relationship. I'm hard-pressed to think of many relationships at that time where there is such a close relationship among such a prominent person and then taking another person trying to have him emulate him. In this story, Bertie Munger is sort of the Branch Rickey character, if you will, if you know the Jackie Robinson story in the Brooklyn Dodgers executive who helps Jackie Robinson break the color line in baseball. Bertie Munger essentially does that for Major Taylor, and he was a very empathetic man. He had ridden a bicycle across the country at a time when very few people had done that, so he saw things close up. He had a view of the country that very few people, other people had. So I think that gave him a unique insight, and one day the executives at the bicycle manufacturing company that Bertie Munger had established came to him and said, you know, we can't associate with a black person. You need to drop Major Taylor. And Bertie Munger instead said, no, I'm going to leave. I'm going to go to Massachusetts, start my own company there, and I'll take Major Taylor with me. And he asked Major Taylor's parents, and they eventually said, okay. So they left Indianapolis because of this racism and moved to Worcester, Massachusetts.
And I have to say that your accounts of Bertie Munger's own racing career made me wince. I mean, he just suffered one injury after another and just kept going. An extraordinary guy. So Taylor is alive in Jim Crow era America, and as you mentioned, Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, had just been decided by the United States Supreme Court. And Taylor faced some really, really intense racism. But there's an extraordinary story that you recount where Bertie Munger takes Taylor to his very first Madison Garden race. Can you set that stage for us?
Sure. This is one of the great extraordinary moments in Major Taylor's life. He had won amateur races along the East Coast, basically, but he hadn't really competed in a professional race. Madison Square Garden, not today's version, of course, but a earlier, more ornate version. That's by what today is Madison Square Park. This was the great arena of America at the time. And one of the great attractions there was the bicycle race. So they would attract 10,000-15,000 people. And if you could imagine an arena that's filled with every strata of society and class and so forth, it's filled with people smoking their cigarettes and pipes. It's very dirty, the grime coming in from all over. In fact, Major Taylor said when he raced there that there was so much grime on some of his competitors that he said they could have passed for his brothers. So it was a very difficult environment in which to race. It was difficult to see even around the oval, according to the racers of the time. And Major Taylor was brought in by Bertie Munger, and he participated first in a half-mile contest against the best sprinters in the world. And his main competitor there was a man named Eddie Cannonball that you mentioned in the open, and his nickname came from being able to shoot like a ball from a cannon. He was so fast. In this race, five laps around the oval, Major Taylor is ahead for the first four laps. He thinks he's won. This is all new to him, really. And amidst all the shouting and so forth, it gets confusing. He thought he was over, and then his trainers basically are screaming to him, no, there's one more lap to go. Eddie Ball is about to pass him, and then Taylor himself, like a ball from a cannon, shoots ahead, wins this. So it was his first professional match. he beats the best sprinters in the world, including Eddie Cannonball. So it was an extraordinary moment. And then as the main event, they have a six-day race, which really was an inhumane spectacle in which, you, as it sounds like, you race around the track for 6 days. You have an hour for rest here and there, and whoever basically survives and does the most laps is the winner. Many competitors basically could not stay in the race for several days, so they would drop out. Incredibly, Major Taylor, even despite at various points being told that he was given special ingredients that would make him be awake and so forth, he thought he saw someone chasing him around the lap with a knife. He would hallucinate. Eventually, he survived 6 days, went 1,700 miles, and came in eighth place, which really was an extraordinary victory as well. So he'd won the sprint match, survived a six-day race, and because this was a race covered by the press from around the world, seeing sprinters from and other racers from different countries, he became an international sensation, and that was in December 1896. So it was an extraordinary way to start his career.
We're talking about Major Taylor, one of the seminal figures in American sports. A new book called The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. Author Michael Cranish is with us today. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So getting back to that first Madison Square Garden race that Taylor won in such spectacular fashion, he almost wasn't allowed to race, was he?
Well, that's right. He had initially gone to the promoters who worked out of Madison Square Garden. They actually were baseball executives, but they weren't making much money in baseball, and cycling was more popular. So he goes in to see these two gentlemen, and one of them says to him, you know, you can't race because you're black. If we allowed you to race, it would cause, you know, riots in New York City, basically. And one of them said to him, shouldn't you be shining the white men's gentlemen's shoes on Fifth Avenue? And Major Taylor basically said, no, I should be allowed to compete against the best white racers. And eventually these promoters were persuaded that this would be a good way to attract more people, that the idea of a race of a black person against the best white racers would draw interest, curiosity. There were newspaper wars going on in New York City at the time, and this is what happened. It became a great story, and it got an awful lot of coverage. So Major Taylor was allowed to compete as a result of that.
So you mentioned Eddie Cannonball, who was in that race in Madison Square Garden. That race actually touched off a major years-long rivalry between Taylor and Bald. Tell us more about Bald. He was pretty racist, was he not?
He was. When he lost the sprint match that I alluded to a few minutes ago, you know, he had a lot of racist epithets, and I came across a number of his comments to you know, what today would be considered pretty obscure cycling publications, but at the time, you know, these were major publications in the sports world. So I got a very good picture. This was he was probably one of the most famous athletes of his time. So forgotten history, certainly today. He's a very handsome individual. He was on the cover of magazines. He was the face of companies that paid a lot of money to have them promote his products. And he envisioned himself as becoming a Broadway star. He's very elegant in the way he carried himself. So he certainly looked down on this young man, Major Taylor. When I looked at the coverage from the New York City newspapers of the time, I found story after story of Eddie Bald. There were pictures of him that were drawn. And then the only reference I initially found to Major Taylor was a tiny reference of his name in agatype, which in newspaper parlance means really, really small. So, you know, no one would have predicted based on that coverage beforehand that Major Taylor would be triumphant. So it gives you a sense of the surprise that Major Taylor held. And throughout their careers, Eddie Bald did try to eventually stop Major Taylor from competing. He eventually feared him. He knew that Major Taylor could beat him on numerous occasions. So he used all sorts of tactics, as other racers did, to try to ban him, citing Jim Crow restrictions. There were death threats against Major Taylor. But in the end, whenever Major Taylor was allowed to compete, and some promoters insisted upon it, he would often beat Eddie Bald. Now, Eddie Bald did win some races as well, but eventually there were promoters that promoted these two men as it was the white Adonis versus the great black racer. So it became a marketing opportunity for promoters, even though Eddie Bald himself tried his best to stop Major Taylor from competing against him.
So there was Eddie Bald, but there must have been some other top riders of the day. And, of course, they were all white who grew to respect Major Taylor. Is that the case?
Yes. You know, there were plenty of riders who did respect him. I mean, basically, as an athlete, they recognized what he could do. In fact, they had such respect, that's one of the reasons they tried to ban him. They felt he was taking their winnings. Cycling was a very profitable venture. Major Taylor could earn more than $10,000 a year. This was an extraordinary amount when the average person might be earning several hundred dollars a year. So, you know, they viewed Major Taylor as taking away their winnings that they felt belonged to them. And in this white-dominated racist society of the time, there were many people who just felt it wasn't right that a black person was allowed to compete and take the winnings. So they cited that. That was a little less common in the North, although there was plenty of racism in the North, very prevalent in the South. So it was extremely frustrating for Major Taylor. But even in a liberal state like Massachusetts, where he lived, there was an incident where he raced before 25,000 people. And at the end of the race, one of his competitors ran to him, choked him, and Major Taylor lay insensible on the track for about 5 minutes till Bertie Munger, came to the track and was able to revive him. So he faced extraordinary racism. I can only imagine not just the physical difficulties that Major Taylor had to go through, but the psychic abrasions that he suffered as a result.
We're talking with Michael Cranish. His new book is The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. You can join us on this subject by calling us at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Michael, for this book, did you analyze Major Taylor's winnings in today's dollars? I mean, I've read over the years claims that, you know, in today's dollars, he earned into the millions and actually would have earned more if he had agreed to race on Sundays.
Well, I don't know if you can say millions, but he was on a number of occasions earning more than $10,000 a year. So an extraordinary sum, more than most people. I describe him as one of the wealthiest African-Americans in Massachusetts. I don't know that we can say absolutely how much he won overall, but he did, after he finished his career, try to start, for example, an automobile tire company, and he put $15,000 of his savings into that. Unfortunately, that business, probably for racist reasons, did not succeed, so he lost that investment. He gave a lot of money away to family and church, so we don't know exactly how much that was. But there's no question, I mean, there's a period of time where he's earning more than Ty Cobb, the great baseball player. So there's no question that he was able to earn an extraordinary amount of money. There just weren't many African-American individuals who were able to do what he did.
Well, in contemporary sports, you know, it's all about money. We hear about, you know, how much Steph Curry makes or what have you. But many of the prizes in that early era of sports weren't actually cash prizes. At one point, didn't Major Taylor win a house or some property?
There were property. You know, there would be a piano. There would be a dining set. You know, there were various things. Major Taylor did want to have, you know, cash for his winnings. He did in the early days in these amateur contests, I think, mostly get other kind of prizes. But there's no question. I mean, he was offered a lot of money. As you mentioned, for religious reasons, he declined to race on Sundays for most of his career. He promised his mother he would do that. And as a result, he lost many tens of thousands of dollars. It's too bad because he needed that money later on and didn't have it. But he felt strongly about that until the very end when he really had no choice.
You know, I loved your story of when Major Taylor bought a house in Massachusetts in what was a white neighborhood. Tell us that story.
Well, unfortunately, it's sort of typical of the time, but few people could have the wherewithal to go around this. So you have typically had, whites on one side of the tracks, you know, sort of a cliche, and blacks on the other side. There was a new development being built of very nice houses in Worcester, and Major Taylor wanted to live in this new development. He didn't see any reason not to. He'd been welcomed to Worcester, unlike in Indianapolis, where, for example, the local YMCA had not allowed him to even train in the Y there, whereas in Worcester, Massachusetts, they welcomed him. So he felt like he would be. Nonetheless, he was concerned, and he arranged for a white individual to actually buy the house, so that there would be no problem and no question. Well, eventually the neighbors obviously figured out that Major Taylor was the person behind that purchase, and they came to the house, and they basically said, you know, we're going to sue you for, you know, buying in our neighborhood. The other people stood up for Major Taylor. Newspapers around the country, particularly in the North, mocked the white neighbors for trying to oust this very successful individual. So in the end, he was able to stay there. And he lived there for most of the rest of his life. I'm happy to say the house is still standing, and I was able to meet with the current owner, and she let me walk through it and help me understand what it looked like when Major Taylor lived there.
Is there any kind of public acknowledgement that that was Major Taylor's house, even a plaque on the wall?
Not at that house, probably for privacy reasons, but in Worcester, Massachusetts, where Taylor did live most of his life, there's a Major Taylor Boulevard. There's even a Major Taylor parking garage, of all things. There's a statue to him that was put up some years ago. So in Worcester, Massachusetts, he's very well known, much more known. Indianapolis, where he grew up, he's pretty well known.
There's the Major Taylor Velodrome in Indianapolis.
Correct. There's a velodrome, not that many in this country, but there is one named after him there. And I have to hope that bit by bit his story gets better known. When I gave book talks in the last few weeks around parts of the country, at every stop I went to, there were groups of Major Taylor clubs. So even though he's not that well known to the general public, these are typically African-American writers, but there's also white writers who are in these clubs, and these groups meet. They go biking, whether it's Saturday or Sunday or whatever it might be, and they have jerseys with Major Taylor's picture on them. So I was very delighted to meet so many of these people who came to book talks. I'm writing a book that's intended for the very mass general public, like hopefully like a book like Seabiscuit or Boys in the Boat. But I just couldn't be more delighted that I had a chance to meet all these people who have, you know, paid honor to Major Taylor, you know, for years, as well as the family. So family members came to my talks as well. I mentioned that I had the privilege of meeting Major Taylor's daughter 18 years ago, and the family, including the granddaughter, great-grandchildren, and so forth, a number of them came to a couple of my book talks, and that was wonderful.
Michael Cranish is our guest this morning. His new book about Major Taylor is called The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. A lot more to come in our last segment on the Jefferson Exchange. Stay with us. We'll be back after a break. And the final segment on today's edition of the Jefferson Exchange. I'm John Baxter in for Jeffrey Riley. We're talking about Major Taylor, an extraordinary figure in the history of sport in the United States, and a new book called The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. Author Michael Cranish is with us this morning. Michael, like many prominent African Americans, especially musicians and artists and writers, Taylor found a more accepting environment in Europe. Although it was far from free of racism, but when he first got to Paris, there was only one other prominent figure in town of African descent. But his career in Europe became a very important part of his life. Can you tell us about that?
It did. Major Taylor was able to be the national champion in the United States, but then he was trying to become world champion. To do that, he first went to Montreal. And I mentioned earlier when he won a race in the U.S., they would play Dixie, the unofficial anthem of the Confederacy, sort of an insult to Taylor. When he won the world championship in Montreal, for the first time, the Star Spangled Banner was played for him. And he said, "I never felt more American than when the Star Spangled Banner was played for me in Canada," if you can imagine that. So then he's courted by the promoters from Europe. They say there's no American they want more than Major Taylor. Taylor, for 2 years, refuses to race there not because he doesn't want to race on Sundays, and they wanted him to. Eventually, they come to a deal where he's able to be racing and not race on Sundays. So he comes over in 1901, and he really is a sensation in Paris. This is the center of cycling in the world, just as it remains so today. And he got extraordinary coverage. This was sort of a new era in also sports photojournalism. Photography had been around for a while, but new techniques had enabled them to catch, you know, racers in motion and better quality images. And so he was featured on the cover of magazines and the newspapers, and it would be hard to not notice Major Taylor being in Paris in 1901. He got so much coverage. The only well-known black at that time in Paris was a man named Chocolat, and he was basically a clown in a circus, but a very good performer, and he was well-known. And there's a quote in the book where someone says, that's not Chocolat, so it must be Major Taylor. Relatively few blacks in Paris were seen at that time. He was the subject of mass adulation. There certainly was plenty of racism in Europe, but they respected his athletic abilities, and they knew that he had been banned from many tracks in America. So they were proud that he was able to race, but they felt that their champion, Edmond Jacquelin, was a better competitor and be able to beat Taylor. But there were lots of stories saying, you know, could Jacquelin beat the great American Taylor and so forth. So eventually there is a race, and in that contest, Jacquelin does win. So Taylor is crestfallen, but he wants a rematch. He's particularly upset because Jacquelin had given Taylor, whose nickname was Major, a mock salute and then held his nose. Taylor was greatly offended at this. So at that point, he says, I demand a rematch. And this brings even more attention, and they have one of the greatest crowds for a sporting event up to that time in Paris. And in the rematch, Major Taylor does win. So again, you know, the world's fastest man triumphs, and that title, you know, is bestowed on him sort of informally again and again. So it's a great moment for him. He wins races all over Europe. He goes to many different countries and is celebrated. So there are instances where he's not allowed to go to this hotel or that hotel, but it's nothing like what he faced in a lot of the United States. He was mostly celebrated. He was accommodated at most of the best places that could be had. So he always felt very warmly, for the most part, towards the French.
And so that begs the question, how long did he stay, and why didn't he stay there for good?
Well, there were entreaties to have him stay there. He the first time he raced, he was planning to be married to a woman that he'd met in Worcester. So he didn't go with her the first time. Eventually, he did take her. And so he did want to return. He was proud to be an American, proud to be a black American. He was just very frustrated that he wasn't allowed to compete fairly. The message of this book is not that here's the story of an athlete who triumphed. It's really, you know, hopefully much larger than that, and that his message was, if you are given a fair chance, if you are allowed to compete equally in what he called any field of human endeavor, not just cycling races, then if you persevere enough against adversity, you can triumph. He hoped that by winning these matches, that he could show the world that the racist theories of eugenics and other things were wrong. He, you know, time and again, he wanted to disprove those theories. So he carried a lot on his shoulders, much more than who would win a certain race and what the standings were. He really felt that he was a symbol, you know, for his race, and that he couldn't afford to fail. He had so much riding on, you know, every contest. And so he put an extraordinary amount of pressure on himself. Eventually, after one season in Europe, he came back and he had what he called nearly a nervous breakdown, but it sounds like he did have one. For 3 years, he didn't race. It was just so difficult. He raced without a helmet. He suffered numerous concussions. He had been through so much difficulty with the racism he faced, particularly in America, that it all just added up. But eventually, he did race again in Europe, and he triumphed again. So he showed the world that, again, he was able to come back and triumph.
So after the turn of the century, you know, as we get into the teens, just before World War I, you know, Americans kind of lost interest pretty quickly in bicycle racing. How did that happen, and why did it stay so popular in Europe?
Well, eventually what happened was the automobile. The automobile took over. People wanted to see auto races. It was all about what's faster. So bicycling was still popular, but more and more people wanted to get an auto themselves, and they wanted to go see auto races. There was a bridging gap here, and that is when they used pacing vehicles. So they'd put a motorized bicycle on the track, or they'd put an automobile on the track, and the bicyclists would race right behind that, which would enable them to ride in the slipstream and go even faster. So Major Taylor did set records going behind motorized pacing vehicles, but eventually people wanted to see just how fast autos could go. That became the new craze. So it's not surprising that would happen. So today, you know, velodrome racing is just not that popular. But at the time, you know, it was the thing. No doubt about it. Major Taylor knew the era was passing. He decided he wanted to go into the auto business himself. So many cyclists did then go into the auto business. Many of the people I write about in the book eventually made that transition as well.
And so Major Taylor got into the automobile business, but things didn't go very well for him at that point.
He was ahead of his time. He had was very familiar with tires, having been a cyclist, of course, and he had the idea of a steel-belted type of auto tire that could survive punctures better, and it was a great idea. It's not 100% clear why this idea did not become profitable. Many businesses don't succeed even with great ideas. The family believes that there were racist reasons, that maybe the idea was taken by somebody else unfairly. What we know is that at one point it seemed like this was going to be a very profitable company, and then in the end, Taylor had put $15,000 and other investors put money into it, and it did not succeed. He then went into other lines of business, but he didn't have a lot of training for business. This was not his background, but he certainly understood, you know, what to do in this field as far as auto racing, because there were many similarities as far as some of the mechanics and particularly tires. So he tried. He certainly had the right idea in transitioning. Unfortunately, it didn't work out, and then, of course, the country gets consumed by World War I, and people move on, and he fears that he may have been forgotten.
So Major Taylor has, you know, you mentioned earlier in this segment that as you've traveled around the country, you've encountered Major Taylor bicycle clubs, and there is a, you know, certainly a growing awareness of his life and his career, but he still remains a relatively obscure figure in sports, certainly compared to other African-American athletes like Jack Johnson or Jesse Owens, you know, Jackie mm-hmm. Robinson. So how much of Major Taylor's relative obscurity in our time owes itself to racism of his era, and how much is it just to the eclipse of track cycling as a spectator sport?
I think it's a couple of things. The fact that track cycling is not well known today, that's certainly part of it. He also came in an era just before there was more widespread use of film, so we don't have film of him, although maybe some archive has some late races, but so far to this date, nothing's come up. There are wonderful, wonderful photos, and I include some of those in the book. There's no audio of him talking. So there's just a variety of reasons, I think, that he's not known. But you mentioned Jack Johnson. Major Taylor was a hero to Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson initially, this is a little-known story, excuse me, that I didn't know and most people didn't know until I did some research here. He initially was a cyclist. He wanted to emulate Major Taylor. One day he was in a cycling match in Texas, had a terrible accident, was hospitalized, and he said later that it was then that he decided he wanted to go into a less dangerous sport, boxing. So it underscores how dangerous cycling was. 11 of Major Taylor's colleagues on the track were killed, maybe even more. Many were injured. You were tightly racing in packs. You had these motorized pacing vehicles ahead of you. It was extraordinarily dangerous. And I think I truly believe if Jack Johnson, Jesse Owens, Jackie Robinson, if they were part of this conversation, that they would say Major Taylor paved the way, because they knew, they would have known of him. Certainly Jack Johnson, no question Jack Johnson knew of him. He actually used the same promoter that Major Taylor used at one point. So I do believe that they would have recognized that Major Taylor paved the way. Major Taylor initially died in obscurity, well, not initially, he died in obscurity, buried in a pauper's grave in Chicago. Later on, there were African-American sports figures who thought this was wrong, and they, with others, helped arrange with the head of the Schwinn Bicycle Company to have him buried in a proper burial with a proper marker recognizing his accomplishments, which is how he is buried today. So there was a recognition later on of his accomplishments. And I do think over time, just as I heard about his story, that more people will recognize that he was, as the second subtitle of the book says, America's first black sports hero.
Michael Cranish is our guest this morning, talking about his new book, The World's Fastest Man. It's a story of Major Taylor. And we just have a couple of minutes left, Michael. I wanted to talk about Taylor's character itself, because one aspect that has always fascinated me about the man is his training regimen and his absolute discipline that must have, not only did it help him on the track, but it seems, especially if you read his autobiography, he established this rules for living, he stuck to them, and that must have helped him cope with the unbelievable racism that he faced.
It really did. I mean, he certainly was bitter about the racism he faced, but he felt that he didn't want to hold that bitterness in his heart. He thought that would undo him. He did use the racism against him as motivation. So to be clear, no question, that was part of his motivation. But he became very skilled in the science of nutrition and athletic training. There's a picture in the book of him as a pretty scrawny 15-year-old when he's first racing. And then not many years later, he's one of the most muscular, well-trained, fittest athletes on the planet. It's an extraordinary comparison. Look at those pictures. He was 5'7" in the 140s for his typical, you know, racing weight. The people he raced against often were 6 feet or larger, much bigger individuals. You look at some group photos, and you're astonished to see how relatively small Major Taylor is by comparison. In today's racing world, he'd be more of a mountain climber given his size. But at the time, he was going against sprinters who were larger. So he said, if I'm an ounce over or under the ideal weight, then he probably couldn't win. He had to be what he called, in quote, perfect condition with perfect form. He includes a photograph of himself wearing just shorts where you see him in that perfect condition and perfect form, because he knew he had to be at that, you know, the apex of conditioning to compete against other riders who were bigger than him.
Yeah, the guy was cut. I mean,
he really was in extraordinary
physical condition. And one of the appendix of your book, you have his training regimen.
Yes.
And I look at that as an aging athlete, and I think, you know, I should do that.
Well, it's very much applicable today. He learned that there were scientific studies of the time by government scientists that basically refuted the eugenics theories that said blacks were inherently inferior. This study found that if you were based on how you're raised, based on what you eat, based on how you train, that everyone could be equal in that way if they have the proper conditioning. And so Taylor used these very early theories of nutrition. He ate an enormous amount of protein. He didn't eat the fatty foods that were so prominent at the time. And this all sounds very familiar today for those people who, you know, study eating habits and try to diet and so forth. He ate prodigious quantities of eggs, for example, to get protein. I can just imagine when you read some of his descriptions, you know, about how many eggs he ate, because that was one of the best ways for him to get protein at the time. It is remarkable, but he really studied that. He really was a student of nutrition and training.
So Taylor wrote and published his own autobiography in the 1920s. It's been in and out of print, mostly out ever since. Mm-hmm. But did you find that was a pretty reliable guide to the man as you did your research?
Well, yes and no. He put a lot of articles verbatim in the autobiography, so it can be a little bit tough reading as a result. It's filled with gems. So for me as an author, I read it probably two or three times at least to go through, because there'll be little nuggets in there that I could then go to. Also, I had thousands of newspaper clippings to rely on. There were ones that he clipped out, many more that have been digitized. So I was really able to use his resources and others to understand his life.
We've been talking with Michael Cranish. He is the author of a new book, The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. Michael, thank you so much for being with us on the Jefferson Exchange for a discussion about a very fascinating figure from our sports history.
Thanks so much for having me.